Hello, Prestige Heads, and welcome to American Prestige. I'm Danny Bessner, here as always with my friend and comrade, Derek Davison, and we're very excited to welcome to the podcast today, Andrew Shankman. Andrew is a professor of history at Rutgers Camden, and he's also the president-elect of the Society for Historians of the Early American Republic. And before we dive in, we wanted to point you to that organization's website. It is shear.org. SHEAR.org, and particularly their civics engagement project. If you want to learn more about early American history and what we're going to talk about on the show today. But Andrew, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure. I'm really, really excited to be talking with you.
Yeah. So this is another entry in our holiday special series. And what we're going to talk about today is the early American Republic and really the decision for that generation of founders. Maybe that's not even the right term anymore for independence. So why don't we just dive right in? And it might be worthwhile to contextualize what's going on in the 13 colonies in the early to mid 1770s that would eventually lead up to this decision to declare independence from the British Empire, which is, you know, going for a long time, but it's really going to reach its apotheosis of power, its apex in the 19th century. So right before that moment.
Yeah. The question of context, which is where people like us always begin, is a perennial one, but also a challenging one, because there's always this tendency to say, well, you got to know about the period before the period, and before lying your back with the Angles and the Jutes, right? So I would say that in order to understand sort of where people are at in the mid-1770s, we'd have to go back a bit before that. And while I don't want to go into too much detail unless you want me to, what I'd say is the one thing I would want to suggest to your listeners, if they're not people who think about the American Revolution all that often and are thinking about it more now because of where we're at, that there's a couple of assumptions I think that a lot of people make, certainly a lot of my undergraduates make, and my graduate students too when they first come in, which there's no easy way to put it, are just wrong. So they kind of get people off on track, on the wrong track. And I think the fundamental assumption that we have is that slowly and inexorably and inevitably over a period of a century or at least decades, people living in North America became so different from people living in Britain and developed such a distinct and different, even early nascent national identity, that by, 1775, 76, it was ridiculous to think that they would remain within the British Empire and that this was what we used to call a no-brainer. It was obvious that you just were going to leave. And as Tom Paine said in 1776, 'tis time to part. And what I suggest is that it makes it very difficult if that's where you start to understand a lot of what people said and a lot of what people thought and a lot of how and why they constructed meaning and how they understood what was happening. And in fact, it's probably best to actually completely reverse that assumption, because in reality, the American Revolution was a very unexpected development that ran counter to most of the trends of the 18th century. And one way to think about this very, very succinctly is to think about what it means to be American in this context. What would be an American way of thinking? And in this very early period before there's actually even a United States, an easy sort of practical working definition of American is something that's distinctly not like what the British are doing, wanting to be different from whatever it is the English or British do. And if that's the definition, then historically, the colonies are actually much more American in the 17th century than in the 18th century. And if you think about all the colonies and even the sort of early stories we know, which always have a sort of a germ of truth, most of those 17th century colonies, which is all but Georgia, are founded as an explicit rejection of some mainstream aspect of England. Right? The Puritans are the most famous examples, but the Pennsylvania Quakers are another. Less famously, the gentlemen who found Carolina, which later splits in North South Carolina, are sort of utopian fantasists who have these ideas about sort of cutting-edge social theory around thinkers like a man named James Harrington. They're all very out of sympathy with the mainstream 17th century and want to kind of show England a better way to do what it's supposed to be doing. And in the 17th century, all of those experiments actually, in fascinating ways, fail spectacularly. The final decades of the 17th century are a horror show, a charnel house, a catastrophe in 17th century North America. At the same time, the English experiment is also failing and descending into civil war and conflict for a second time, and then culminating with a revolution in 1688. And what's interesting is that the 18th century is a period in which a lot of that begins to change for reasons that are complex. I can go into if you really want me to, but the English state becomes much more effective at mobilizing resources and money, spending that money dramatically, building what we think of as the first British Empire, which is much more an 18th century story than a 17th century story. And in many ways, the North American colonies also begin to develop much more dynamic, successful, complex, sophisticated societies. Really, they begin to people the North American seaboard much more than they had in the 17th century, gain dominion over it, a measure of hegemony. And in doing so, they really begin to become much more integrated into in something we could functionally call a working British Empire. As a result, they actually begin to recreate, develop, have the capacity to begin to develop much, much more aspects of British economy, society, culture, and are much more integrated into the British Empire. And this is a very rare thing, because what historians today have a fancy term for it. We call this a settler colonial process, which, unlike a traditional colonial process, is not one where you're extracting resources and violently brutalizing native peoples. That's a 17th century story. The 18th century story, what they're largely trying to do is replace those native peoples with their own presence and actually recreate something that looks a lot more like the world they left behind. And they're successfully doing that. And while all European colonizers to some degree in the 18th century are trying to do that, the British are much, much more successful at it than the French or the Spanish. The best example I can give of this is that when the French and the British fight in the famous 7 years of French Indian War, there are about 1.2 million British North Americans, and there are about 70,000 French Canadians. Right? And that's the difference, right? That's a settler colonial enterprise as opposed to one that's not nearly as successful.
So I've got to jump in. Why? So, I mean, this is obviously libraries on this question, but what is the reason why there is a more in the Spanish imperial context, for example? There's settling, but there's more of this impulse towards bringing in native peoples as opposed to totally displacing them with people that you will ship in from the British Isles. What is sort of like the obviously huge question, but what is the historiographical consensus, if there is one now?
I mean, yeah, it is a huge and vast question, and it's different. There's no one answer. I mean, Spanish America, which is Central and South America, is rather different even from the French, Canada, and the British seaboard. But broadly, I would say that England has unique both push and pull conditions that are not present in the same degree in France and Spain. It's much smaller. Its population is much more highly concentrated. It's much harder. The push effects is that it's much harder to actually increasingly find. The surplus population is actually a much more of a problem in England than in France or Spain. Just simple things like families with property in France are able to practice partible inheritance, where they can actually divide up holdings among family members. England very much more quickly goes to primogeniture, where the eldest son inherits most. And that's because if you continually divide up smaller amounts of land, for example, land will be increasingly, the holdings will not be sustainable. So you have a younger son phenomenon in England much, much more than in France or Spain. There's also, but all through the social order, there's much more push effects out of the British Isles. And then North America, as they begin to sort of get some purchase and take some control over the North American seaboard, begins to have a lot of pull effects as well. There's all kinds of ways in which you can realize opportunities in the 18th century North America, as it becomes somewhat safer, comparatively safer than the 17th century to try there, that are very attractive. One example of this is that a lot of soldiers who are pushed into North America through British military endeavors often decide to stay in North America after those wars, which also suggests that there's not a lot of hostility to the British military much before the 1770s. A lot of soldiers fighting in the Seven Years' War, which ended in 1763, both officers and men stay in North America because there are opportunities there. But this, the long story of this, the punchline of all of this, is that what you're getting in the 18th century is North American societies that are beginning to look a lot more like British provincial societies. And because of that, with their large size and their large population, what you have is an interesting phenomenon, which is not really as true in other British colonies or other European empires, which is increasingly a vast population of people living at a vast distance that also thinks that it's British. And it feels entitled to the exact same rights and the exact same conditions and the exact same mentality and identity as people living in the British Isles. But they're thinking that way in a challenging 18th century where distance is a reality, where space and time are much more challenges than they would be today. And so exactly how 18th century institutions are meant to function across such a vast space and distance. One example, like Parliament, which is in the 18th century emerging as a genuine representative body for property owners and taxpayers. But how does a representative body for property owners and taxpayers that's meant to represent people who can live at most a 3 or 4 days travel away function for increasingly a group of 1 million people with 400,000 or 500,000 property owners living 3,000 miles in an ocean away? So there are just challenges in the British Empire that are heightened and real. But what I want to suggest also is those challenges do come from real successes of the British Empire as it does begin to gain a measure of hegemony and authority in the British portions of North America that are unprecedented. So it's not inevitable this has to be a problem. This could be a solution. And we can talk a bit if you want about how a lot of the challenges that begin to provoke conflicts in the 1770s come up prior to that in the 1750s and early 1760s and actually lead to much more successful resolutions. So an American Revolution is not inevitable. And in fact, if you're looking at the cyclical developments of the 18th century, it would suggest a greater sense of, certainly a greater integration into the British Empire and a greater sense of shared Britishness. But that also heightens expectations about what it means to be a British subject that then have to be delivered on.
Yeah, I think maybe it's worth talking a little bit about the course of the mid 18th century, and particularly, I think maybe we'd be interested in what is the British perspective? Because you get the American perspective, you get the this is unfair, no taxation without representation. You're treating us as a subject people, and we expect to be treated as British citizens, just like anybody else. What's the British perspective on all of these disputes as they're going on?
Yeah, it's a really good question. And again, although you're both historians, so you get this all the time too. I mean, when sort of the civilians ask us, and we inevitably give the historian's answer, they always get very frustrated because the answer is, well, it's really complicated. And one thing to say is there is actually no one British perspective, and there is no one North American perspective for that matter. But I won't leave it there, right? I mean, so let me try to give you a sense of kind of the possibilities in play and the way things could go and do go. So to boil it down, what we all know, and we're not wrong to know it, it's largely true, is that, there isn't a great imperial crisis that kind of begins around the mid-1760s and really heats up in the early 1770s and then blows apart in the mid-1770s. And fundamentally, it's, initially kind of over three big sources of conflict, right? Which are, one, the Americans are expected to bear some cost for their own defense. And so there's going to be taxation from Parliament for doing that. And two, that they're also, as part of that, expected to quarter troops and accept troops within their communities, British troops. And then third, therefore, they're supposed to actually show some sort of respectful deference to those troops and actually, be comfortable with the presence of a British military presence among them. And so one way to think about sort of the British perspective on this is to think about and to see that it's varying is to see that those kinds of questions are not new. And those kinds of expectations are not new starting in, say, 1765 with the Stamp Act. But how they're approached and handled is different. So, for example, all of those expectations exist during the Seven Years' War, which is this major conflict that actually it's part of a series of wars that the British are fighting with the French and they both have allies. The British are often allied with Prussia, the French often with Spain. It really began in the late 17th century and don't really end until Napoleon's defeat in 1815. So we talk about a long 18th century that goes from 1689 to 1815 and is largely the British and the French either at war or preparing to be at war. But the Seven Years' War is, to that point, the largest of those wars. And it's the first one that actually begins in North America. So it's showing the increasing presence and importance of North America. It really heats up in 1756 and continues on the continent of North America until 1761 and then in the North, and then in the Caribbean until 1763. And in that war, which is a vast, huge logistical challenge and deeply, deeply expensive, the British have the same expectations they will have after the war. They want the Americans to pay for the cost of their own defense, to contribute actually to British military initiatives. They want the Americans to quarter British troops, and they want the American colonial forces to embed themselves in a respected British military chain of command, and particularly British officer corps. And what's interesting initially is that the initial approach to that comes from a group of really hardline British policymakers who are grouped around a man named the Duke of Cumberland, who's an interesting figure. If you know your Scottish history, he is known as Billy the Butcher of the Battle of Culloden, right? Who, so that's how you handle colonial upstarts, marginal peoples like the Highland Scots who aren't respecting British authority, right? He's also the king's uncle, so he's a big deal, though they don't get along very well. And grouped around him are a lot of people who a good friend of mine named Jeffrey Plank has called authoritarian civilizers. Figures who see the British Empire as a civilizing project, but essentially it needs to bring civilization with authority and power, because people like the Highland Scots don't know otherwise. And in many ways, these guys really cut their teeth around suppressing the 1745-46 Jacobite Rising, and then interpret other colonial experiences through that. And one of the keys of these is a man named Lord Loudon, who initially in 1756-57 is the commander of the British forces in the North American theater. And so he has these expectations, right? Again, let's remember, pay for troops, quarter troops, respect the British military command. And his approach is to be an authoritarian, right? So he goes to colonial governors, most of whom, and in the case of Massachusetts, including Massachusetts, are royally appointed. And since he's the commander of the British troops and is actually in wartime, has authority over them, orders them to order the colonial legislatures to raise taxes to meet his needs. And what colonial legislatures say, and you mentioned it, is they use the phrase that is ubiquitous in the 17th century in England: no taxation without representation. Right? They say, look, if a military leader is simply, basically through an unelected royal governor, treating our legislatures essentially as like a ventriloquist dummy, I mean, they're, I guess, nominally assessing the taxing, but only under the authority of an unaccountable, unelected military figure. This isn't the protection of property that comes when taxes are only assessed by people who are voted on and who pay the taxes. Right? And very famously, in the midst of the war, they refuse. People don't know this. 1758, March 1758, Massachusetts legislature says, we're no longer participating in the Seven Years' War, which seems like a pretty astonishing thing to say, right?
I am by training an intellectual historian. So where do these ideas come from? Because this is also the Enlightenment and So let's talk about that. Like, where do these people get that? So there's obviously this vast distance, which is going to have some material reality effects there. But this is also the American Revolution in particular is often pointed to as like the first Enlightenment revolution or one of them. Yeah. I guess 1688 as well, but in the Hobbesian context.
Yeah, and so let's go in that direction, but then let's get back to this moment, because we want to sort of talk about how that gets resolved. So one of the things that's happening in this 18th century, which as I suggest is a period of real integration and really the construction of a British Empire, and the key is to see that this construction is happening around a convergence of North American colonists and British imperial British subjects, all kind of developing a certain kind of idea of Britishness roughly at the same time. And the key is to see that term Britain, which is used in the 18th century, isn't a crucial one, because Britain is an 18th century construction, right? Britain doesn't really exist in the same way in the 17th century. I mean, officially, it's the official act of union of England and Scotland into the Kingdom of Great Britain in the 18th century. But over the course of the 18th century, the idea of being British is something that, the key is that you don't have to be English to be British. Scots can be British. Highland Scots aren't, but Lowland Scots are. British people living in provincial cities, provincial capitals, and port cities like Philadelphia, North America, Philadelphia, Boston, New York, Charleston can be British. It's really more about values and ideas and practices. And in a classic way, I mean, scholars like, say, Habermas and Benedict Anderson, who talk about public spheres and imagined communities and print capitalism, that doesn't just have to formulate national identity. In this case, in the 18th century, can really formulate a British identity, which is also imperial identity. So this greater integration, this greater kind of colonial community, that means that you're reading the same prints, you're observing, you're seeing the same artwork. Everybody's devouring Hogarth's depictions of the vile, beastly French, who, again, remember, aren't 3,000 miles in an ocean away. Just they're also a day's march from Massachusetts in Canada. They're also glorying in the idea that the British monarchy stands strong for liberty, in the phrase of Jack Green, because it has a different kind of monarchy, one that is bounded by law, limited and constitutional. The protection of property, they insist, has been placed at the heart of British political culture. And the point is, that's as much an imperial culture as it is one for the British Isles. So these are, very much, very much these sort of ideas about the relationship of governors to govern, the idea of contract theory, a lot of notions we associate with the Enlightenment, particularly the idea of a public sphere and public opinion and an informed citizenry and an engaged citizenry, are all parts of this. But that doesn't necessarily have to lead to conflict between North America and its British colonies. It can and ultimately will, but it can also lead to a shared sense of a British imperial identity. Now, there can be, that means that you have expectations. And so if you're getting back to Loudon, he's not meeting them, right? In that March 1758, when he's saying, I as a military figure will decide what British subjects with all the rights that I've just talked about have, how they will pay taxes and when they will pay taxes. To the American colonists, they're saying, well, that's not what British subjects get to do, right? I mean, we're not French. We don't live under the Calais, outside of the Calais gate, you know, and all those, you know, depictions of horrible, you know, of French people, Hogarth prints, right? We have these rights and we will stand on them. Now, what's interesting is that within a few days of that incredible confrontation in the midst of war, news arrives. So clearly it's not about this confrontation. It takes much longer. But news arrives that the ministry that has placed Loudon in position has fallen and been, you know, not exactly fallen, but the leaders of the ministry have changed and a new person has come in to manage the war effort named William Pitt. And what Pitt does is he revives some older methods for funding war in North America. And what he says, and he announces this through the royal governors to the legislatures, that going forward each year, he will set aside a fund of specie of gold and silver to a total of £200,000 per year. And if North American legislatures choose to tax themselves and choose to contribute to the war effort, they can draw upon the fund for reimbursement of their colonial expenses anywhere from 33 to 40% of those expenses. Now, this is a little complicated, so let me go through it. So when colonists tax themselves to, say, raise troops or, you know, provide contracts to gun makers or to shoemakers or to tailors to make uniforms, all of that is happening in local colonial paper currencies, which have some value, though it fluctuates because it's not clear exactly what if it's backed by anything of permanent tangible value, like, say, pound sterling or gold and silver. And there's scarce gold and silver in the colonies because as colonies that produce tend to produce more raw materials rather than finished products and manufactured items, which they buy from Britain, there's always an imbalance of trade because raw materials are not as, you know, they'll cost less than finished products that they're buying, manufactured they're buying from Britain. And you can't make up those balances of trade with local colonial currencies. Those British merchants wouldn't accept them. So they will want to accept gold and silver for the balance. And that tends to leave the colonies, which can make colonial paper currencies precarious. So they're always looking for ways to have more gold and silver. So what Pitt is now saying is if you contribute to the war effort within your local colonial economies by using your paper money where it does function reasonably well and works, you can draw upon the specie fund, and we will actually ship specie to North America that you can draw upon to reimburse a portion of your expenses, which will give a ballast to your paper currencies and further, therefore, improve and lubricate your own colonial economies, which provides a great incentive to actually contribute voluntarily and participate in the war effort. Now, if you think about that, none of that violates the colonists' sense of their British liberties. Right? This is all, I mean, the colonies, the legislatures doing the taxing are representative, right? Colonial citizen subjects do vote for them. Those colonial legislatures have to pay the same taxes they're requiring other people to pay. Those are the two conditions for taxation connected to representation. And it's entirely voluntary. And so what Pitt turns is an onerous demand that seems to be creating second-class subjecthood and violating British liberty into an incentivizing process for them to do exactly the same thing. And the result is that colonists begin to tax themselves actually voluntarily at levels higher than the sugar and stamp tax will then come back and kind of restoring the Loudon position and doing authoritarian, you know, through an authoritarian degree. And he does the same thing with quartering. Basically, it's the same process. They can get reimbursed. That will be replaced after the war with the Quartering Act, which basically coercively requires them through parliamentary fiat to do what they had been voluntarily doing. And in interesting ways, they take care of the they create an effective military chain of command in which colonial officers work well with British officers. If you really want it, I can go into detail, but we have to get into other things. The point is that all of these these same expectations, which will create great conflict in the late 1760s and early 1770s, are all there during the war under much more difficult conditions when they need a lot more resources than they even need later. And they don't cause conflict because ministers like Pitt, who clearly have a different mentality than ministers like Loudon or like Cumberland, approach the colonists very differently. So Pitt is a hero in North America. He's called the Great Commoner. Pittsburgh is named after him, Pittsfield, Massachusetts. And he, in fact, is deeply hostile to the Grenville Revenue Program of the Sugar and Stamp Acts because he has an expectation and understanding that the way to approach the British subjects of North America has to be filtered through the more challenging conditions of this vast settler colonial societies that are so far away.
So that's really, really helpful for understanding the context that gets us to the 1760s. One thing I do want to focus on, in addition, are the persons who make up this generation of people that would actually do this. So this is super helpful material, cultural and intellectual context, but like, who's George Washington? Who's Thomas Jefferson?
Yeah.
Where are these people coming from? Might be also worthwhile talking about the locus of power in the colonies seems to be in this presently the southeastern United States. Famously, this is going to erupt later in the American Civil War. But who are these people? Where do they come from? What do we need to know about them beyond like the image people might have in their minds?
Sure.
Who this generation is?
So one thing, and with some exceptions, I mean, Benjamin Franklin was born in 1706. But one thing to note is that they're actually comparatively young men in the period that we're talking about. I mean, Washington's a little older than Jefferson, who's a little older than Madison, who's a little bit older than Hamilton. But even Washington was born in 1732. So during the decades we're talking about, he's in his 30s. And Hamilton was born, Hamilton is 19 when the Declaration of Independence is declared. He's actually was an infant during the Seven Years' War. So what they note is that they're young. And therefore, their formative period of experience is during either the middle decades of the 18th century or even like sort of getting towards the final quarter of the 18th century, which for the most part had been a period of where the British Empire in the 18th century had really reached its zenith and been in its most successful. So for a long period of time, people like Franklin, who really, I mean, he really becomes the Franklin we know starting in 1750 when he retires and becomes he's made enough money to no longer be a laboring person and we can kind of become the kind of intellectual and sort of citizen of the world that we all think of Franklin as. But people like even Franklin, who's older, and Washington, I mean, their real adult experiences are in the 1750s and early 1760s, when in fact the British Empire is a really attractive thing to be part of. And so famously, Washington, who actually, as I said, it starts in the Seven Years' War starts in North America, and people may famously know, Washington as a young man actually kind of is there when it starts, right? It's this really murky encounter between British and British colonials and British allied native peoples and French and French colonials and French allied native peoples. And actually it's native peoples who are fighting and they're always fighting their own very complex conflicts in which they're incorporating, from their perspective, incorporating these European allies into their pre-existing conflicts, who actually have a conflict with each other and a French soldier is killed. Now, again, this is pretext. There's already a deep, they're all there because there's conflict over the Ohio River Valley and these great empires are going to, basically kind of contest for it. But the point of all of this is that Washington's there because he is seconded to and working with the British military. And he then continues to work with the British military in the Seven Years' War. And his experiences are such that by the end of it, he seeks a commission in the British Army. And a great counterfactual, they don't accept it. He doesn't go in. But a great counterfactual question to consider is, what if they had? I mean, he's the kind of person you tend to go for. I mean, if Washington had, if his request for a commission had been accepted and he'd been brought into the British military and then say, I don't know, transferred to India, which could easily have happened, it would have been a very different story. And so the thing you want to know about these gentlemen, and that's sort of the 18th century conception for property owners who don't have to, who others labor for rather than labor for themselves, is that many of them are coming of age, educated in, trained in this world where British imperial subjecthood is increasingly wildly available and also increasingly seemingly attractive, which means that they're really in the vanguard of having these expectations of what it means to be a British subject. And they will measure those expectations against the treatment they're getting when there's an abrupt shift away from, say, more of a pit approach to how to deal with these complex and sophisticated and challenging British societies to one that is going back to a more authoritarian sensibility. And that is therefore note that the authoritarian sensibility doesn't have different expectations of outcomes. It has different methods of approaching those outcomes, which can then really force British subjects to start articulating what they think their liberties and rights as British subjects are. And then if that creates kind of conflict and intransigence, that can lead to greater conflicts that will then may or may not ultimately prove intractable.
So the Seven Years' War ends early 1760, 1763. Bring us through the rest of that day and into the early 1770s. What's happening in relationship between Britain and the colonies, and also between, I think, the colonists and the indigenous population in the wake of what we refer to here as the French and Indian War, but is the Seven Years' War in North America?
Other way around, actually. But yeah, Seven Years' War, and then it's called, the Americans call it the French Indian War.
Right.
Yeah. So, right. So in many ways, if you think about what I sort of contrast the Pitt and Loudoun approaches to the same outcomes. That's in microcosm, a really, really big and pressing and perennial question about how do you govern an empire? And what the Seven Years' War, French Indian War, did was it really showed in microcosm that you can govern an empire in ways that will solidify it, make it more successful, really foster further and greater integration and connection, or you can govern an empire in a way that will provoke and potentially lose it, right? In microcosm, when Massachusetts opts out of the war for a week in 1758, they've lost Massachusetts for a week, right? And that's that could have metastasized and become a bigger and bigger deal. And then it's addressed, right? And so the question, you know, if you think about the Pitt approach, one question that a lot of imperial, you know, statesmen asked was, well, is that strength or is that weakness? And my own perspective is it's strength, right? I mean, if you think about these, you know, here's an 18th century society, right, which has all the drawbacks of communication and travel that we know 18th century peoples had. It's got to traverse a vast ocean and then go into a vast landmass, which is much larger than Britain itself, with a population that's already close to a third the size of Britain, but is also a large population, but also very far spread out and increasingly moving further and further from the coastline. On the oceans, you have this British Navy, which is becoming pretty incomparable and impressive, but there's nothing like that institution as you get into the mainland of North America. There's really no coercive capacity to make North Americans do anything that they don't really want to do. And the Massachusetts decision to zero fund the war for a week demonstrates that. So I always felt, here's Pitt, without any coercive ability, really, convincing the colonists to raise huge amounts of money. And 20,000 North American troops are raised, right, to fight in the Seven Years' War, which is a huge percentage of the population of Massachusetts and New England, risk their lives, subordinate themselves to the British Empire, largely voluntarily, right? Now, you could say, well, they had to pay for it. But, you know, if you look at, you know, altogether, you know, the amount of money that Pitt spends on the war, which is 10 times the amount the French can spend on the North American theater, amounts to about 0.1% of the British public debt in 1763. So I've always felt that was a pretty good return on investment. Right? On the other hand, so you could take and Pitt's perspective and the perspective of some other policymakers who come along a bit later who don't get as much attention, who I think are important, we can talk about it, who resolved the Stamp Act crisis, is look how impressive this is, right? Spending essentially a rounding error for us, the change in the couch, a comparatively little bit of money, we can get people 3,000 miles in an ocean away who are notoriously difficult and difficult to govern, at least by reputation, to be governable. And the result is that we secure the greatest victory that the British Empire has ever imagined, right? And if you were to go to a sort of a Whig partisan of the Glorious Revolution in 1691 and say by 1763, little England will have conquered North America, and you know, I mean, on paper, but certainly conquered it, in the perspective of the French government. The French government will be expelled from North America. The colonies will have a population of 1.5 million people, and will have raised hundreds of thousands of pounds and tens of thousands of troops to support British military efforts. There's no Whig in 1694 wouldn't take that deal and think that they'd achieved everything they wanted. On the other hand, you know, during the Seven Years' War, the British public debt grew from about 70 million pounds to about 132 million pounds. So it's very expensive. Now, again, fraction of that cost in North America, but you know, expensive. They had zero funded the war for a period of time. They had, if you're coming from the mentality of someone who's more authoritarian and you're thinking about the challenging nature of British colonial governance, there are a lot of things you could point to that Pitt would identify as strength that you could identify as weakness. And you could say need to be addressed. And there is definitely, this gets back to your question of what the British position is. Well, there's different British positions, but one certainly is a sense that the Seven Years' War demonstrates a lesson of a growing and increasing American ungovernability, challenges, a need to have a more forceful hand, and a need to build upon this great victory to reintroduce the North Americans to British imperial authority. Now, I think that Pitt was correct. I think that's the worst possible thing you could do. And in many ways, the British actually weren't thinking triumphantly. We very quickly would lurch away from all of the lessons they learned about how to win a war and how to keep an empire to the lessons that had already actually showed them how to lose a war and lose an empire. But though that spectrum of thought is all there in 1763. And the result is that Pitt actually falls very quickly. Now he falls mostly because he's furious that they decided in the peace to give back a lot of what they've achieved in the French West Indies to the French and to the Spanish. They conquer all, I mean, they don't just conquer North America. They conquer all of the Spanish and French West Indies too. Had they kept all of that, that would have been a really interesting 18th century. So there would have been nowhere left to smuggle, and there would have been no more, I mean, they would have all been British. It would have all been, they'd have all just, you know, been trading happily in the British Empire. But you know, the point is that, you know, some British policymakers can see weakness in what others might see as strength and integration. And if those people do win out for a period of time, which introduces the Sugar and Stamp Acts, which then have the kinds of impact that you would have predicted looking at the experience of Loudoun in Massachusetts a few years earlier.
So one of the things I'm curious about in this period is the proclamation in 1763 puts this arbitrary line along the Appalachians and says the colonies are bordered here and everything else. Because this is often brought up as like a counterfactual, like what would the indigenous population of North America, what would their experience have been had the revolution not happened, had the British stayed? And this is sometimes, you know, talked about in that context. And I guess, you know, the argument that they would have been better off is countered by the history of the British Empire everywhere else in the world. But I'm sort of curious. That's why I asked about the relationship between the indigenous and the colonists.
Thank you for reminding me of that. Yeah,
I'm interested in that particular question.
Yeah. And again, as I say, I mean, we're historians, and I think people who listen to this show are pretty sophisticated. So you know that, you know, historians disagree a lot. So, I mean, there are, you know, let me just preface by saying I have a view of that and I'll give it to you. You could probably find other people who would say something different. But I think that the proclamation line itself, I don't think is very significant, but that doesn't mean that a lot of the things that it's trying to address aren't significant. So let me talk about that. So for example, in the year that the proclamation line was enacted in 1763, a lot of people also don't know that they abandoned it in 1768, by the way. So it's not there for the entire period of time. But in 1763, the year that the proclamation line was enacted, there are so few people living west of it that they're not worth counting. All right. So there's no proclamation line that's preventing that. It's the conditions of the Ohio River Valley that are preventing that. In 1768, when the British abandoned the proclamation line, again, this is my memory, but I think there was between 50 and 70,000 people living west of it. So in that sense, in many ways, as with, you know, what proclamation line is one of a series of acts that we could talk about, we could show, which shows the huge disjuncture between the British, the actual practical authority the British have on the oceans as compared to the interior. We're in the interior, as I said, in this vast settler colonial space with this vast population. It's very hard to make colonists do something in the interior they really don't want to not do, right? You can't make them fund a war if they really don't want to do it, but you can get them to fund a war if you approach them in ways that will really, speak to their British sensibilities and mentality. You can't prevent colonists from going west. What can prevent colonists from going west is the conditions of the West. And if those conditions are seen increasingly as more viable, still dangerous, but more viable, they will go west. And that will happen. And now what Native peoples are doing is in a deeply, deeply spirited and committed way is trying to limit westward expansion. And that's been increasingly since the mid-18th century, there's been increasingly a pan-Indian commitment to trying to do that from the Gulf Coast to the Great Lakes. What the colonists call the French Indian War is as much part of that, another part of that process as anything else. The Native peoples don't end fighting in 1761 in North America when the French largely leave the North American theater and conflicts spread to the Caribbean. They also don't end fighting when the French and British formally end the war in 1763 in what's known as the war, what used to be called Pontiac's Rebellion. Now it's more commonly we call it a war associated with the name Pontiac, which rages through the Great Lakes and Lower Canada, continues into 1764 and 65. And the proclamation line is part of a British effort to address some of the challenges and complexities that they're finding in the Appalachian region and the Great Lakes region. As I said, it doesn't actually have much to do with whether North Americans are going to go west or not. And in many ways, what a really good book, a book by a historian named Greg Dowd, which I think is probably the best discussion of this, which is called War Under Heaven, has shown is that the British have every intention of spreading their empire west and of conquering the Great Lakes and of supplanting Native peoples and of spreading the settler colonial enterprise. What they want to do is they want to do it under British authority, making sure that their concerns about ungovernability don't get ahead of their coverage, as they would say, right? So this needs to be done methodically, it needs to be done deliberatively, and it needs to be done top down. And there are plenty of North American elites who agree with that. I mean, Benjamin Franklin is really frightened about the obstreperous, ungovernable Westerners as well. Indeed, in many ways, he sees them as the true savages and native peoples who are often depicted as savages as far more, you know, reasonable and sensible than, say, you know, the Paxton Boys of 1763, who are this group of you know, really, you know, virulent Indian haters who then actually move from having committing violence on Native peoples to marching on Philadelphia because they're so angry about the Quaker government not supporting them. But a lot of, you know, the people, you know, who have an inclination to move west are going to move west based upon their sense of whether that's physically something they can do. And a proclamation line isn't going to change that. So, yeah, in many ways, what's interesting is that when you're looking at this period, 1764, 65, 66, it's not as if coastal North American British elites are that in sympathy with Westerners going out and provoking lots of conflicts that they'd rather not be fighting and that they don't think are necessary. And in many ways, I think that those kinds of conflicts, as the Paxton Boys March in Philadelphia suggests, is there's as much internal division within North America as there is anything about, say, a British versus North American conflict over, say, a proclamation line, which is, again, shows the many crisscrossing currents of complexity and alliance here. But one common denominator I would say is that Native peoples increasingly know who to align against. And in the 1760s, they align with, and the numbers tell the tale. They see the French Empire as far more able to be incorporated into their own native sense of what this North American continent should look like. And when finally the British Empire does break apart, they see the British imperial government as far more capable of being incorporated into their own native aspirations for the colony, for the continent, than the new aggressive Republican American Republic. All right, and so yes, I mean that, and in many ways, I mean, that's where you can kind of distinguish. If you think about all the various peoples who the new American Republic will marginalize, you know, peoples who are not white, peoples who are not male. In many ways, the one thing that separates, I'd say, Native peoples from all those other groups that they would seek to marginalize is that what all those other groups are doing is demanding access to the fundamental ethos and possibilities of the new American Republic, whereas Native peoples are fundamentally demanding separation and limitation of the American Republic. And so they're the one group that really can't, in the same way, try to repurpose and make use of, say, the American Republic's founding documents. You know, abolitionists can make use of them. Women can make, I mean, Seneca Falls, famously, they do, right? The Declaration of Independence is a key text for a lot of early critics of slavery. Not much in it that can offer much to Native peoples, right? Because fundamentally what they're arguing is not about how to organize and govern material relations on the land, but who will possess the land.
The new issue of the interdisciplinary journal Social Research explores how the way we write and the meaning of writing are rapidly changing. It asks how artificial intelligence transforms norms and expectations that for centuries associated writing with voice, originality, and agency. If writing is a technology that restructures thought, as philosopher Walter Ong put it, then which written forms of thought and reflection will survive AI, or conversely, will be enabled by it? What new literacies are required? How will new technologies rework the relationship between writing and the marketplace? In 9 groundbreaking articles, the summer 2026 issue of the journal tackles these and other questions that pertain to the issue's title, Writing in the 21st Century. Social Research is the flagship journal of the New School for Social Research in New York City. You can find the journal on Project Muse or at www.socres.org. That is www.socres.org.
So why don't we turn to the imperial crisis of the mid-1760s, and particularly the Stamp Act crisis of 1764-1765.
Sure, yeah. So in many ways, I think that to understand why the American reaction to this abrupt shift in policy is so decisive and so angering is because they know now, they have experienced and have had full sense of now what we have some sense of, which is that the same issues and questions had been brought up in the Seven Years' War and handled very differently in ways that didn't provoke them and didn't challenge in their minds needlessly their own sense of British imperial selfhood and identity and liberty. So clearly, as Pitt fell, and he's replaced by a man named George Grenville, who, given the way that British politics works, believe it or not, is his brother-in-law. And Grenville is not necessarily completely opposed to Pitt's methods, but the new young king, George III, and his closest advisors, the Earl of Bute, do definitely fall into the side that the Pitt approach more expresses weakness than strength. As I said, you know, he doesn't necessarily see completely eye to eye with his uncle, the Duke of Cumberland, on a lot of things. The Hanoverians famously had a lot of family drama, but I think he's influenced by his uncle. And George III, I should remember, also stress, is a young man. He's in his 20s. His uncle is in his 40s. He's seen as, you know, he's a sort of more seasoned and veteran figure of the empire. And George is also convinced that, you know, by the position that there needs to be kind of a more regularized and organized and more directed method of colonial governance. And so what this, and George Grenville certainly has some inclinations in that way as well. And so what they do, and this is for the first time, is decide to address the needs of imperial, the cost of defense, and the need to quota troops through parliamentary taxation of the colonies. So now it will be Parliament, the House of Commons, that will be taxing the colonies, which has the same impact it had in 1758. This is seen as no taxation without representation, a violation of British liberties. Again, remember, you'd only think in those terms and even have that kind of category of analysis if you were firmly convinced of your own Britishness. So if you remember back to where we began, it's exactly the opposite of what we think. It's because they become so convinced that they are British imperial subjects as well, that they can articulate why they think this is wrong.
Is there a notion of race and whiteness yet? Or is this just purely notions of citizenship?
So that's really an interesting question. And there is some, and it's both. So James Otis, who writes against the first of the Grenville taxes, which is the less famous, the Sugar Act, but they need to both be understood because the reaction to them, but also the contrast of the outcomes of them are interesting. But as he's explaining why the Sugar Act is wrong, what he's really hitting is these themes of we're British subjects. But he's also very committed to distinguishing between the North American colonies and the West Indian colonies. Not because the West Indian colonies should be treated differently. He says they're, you know, the British people living there shouldn't be taxed without representation either. But he says is the British West Indians, I mean, and by that he means the white West Indians living in Jamaica and Barbados, have a less capacity to preserve and care for liberty because they're so entrenched in slavery. And being the domineering, authoritarian figures that they are, as they trample on the liberties of others, they just become less capable of understanding and valuing and cherishing liberty. And they're the ones who are pushing the Sugar Act. The Sugar Act benefits them, he says. And so what you have is, in many ways, they say that the fact that Parliament is now taxing us because the worst examples of British subjects are advising them suggests that there is this pernicious notion, connection to not respecting liberty in certain areas and then not respecting it in other areas. And he goes on to say, he begins to articulate an early conception of whiteness. He says, unlike the mongrel conception of population of the West Indies, which are heavily not white and are heavily not free, we are a population of free and white people. Now, again, you have to kind of ignore the reality of slavery in this everywhere, but you know, again, it's most ubiquitous south of, you know, of New York. And indeed in South Carolina, that colony actually has a majority of enslaved peoples. It's the one place where that's true. It's true everywhere in the British West Indies. But it is the case, and he can be credited. He's right to say that slavery writ large is not as central to the North American colonial experience as it is, say, to Jamaica or Barbados. So in many ways, yes, there is this sense, but that's a way of arguing for a shared Britishness that's more central and ubiquitous in North America.
Right, precisely. And it prefigures the Anglo-American stuff of the fin de siècle, where you're talking about race very, very explicitly. Right, that's why I was curious.
So yeah, so that isn't necessarily going to be a source of imperial conflict. It could be a source of imperial integration, but it will then play in because what they'll in some sense begin to believe is that in denying them their British liberty, they're also denying that they're white people.
Right, right. So let's return to this imperial crisis.
Yeah. So what Grenville does then is he enacts two taxes. So a Sugar Act, which actually lowers the duty on French West Indian molasses. The duty had been very high for 30 years, though it hadn't really been enforced, but it had been very high and was meant to be unaffordable, which would mean that it would be very costly if you got caught with French molasses, which meant it was meant to be discouraging from going there. And in complicated ways, what colonists said was, well, that's actually legitimate because Parliament should regulate behavior for the good of the empire. What it shouldn't do is be seeking revenue by taking a portion of a subject's property. And that's not the intention here. It's sort of like a prohibitive penalty for discouraging behavior. In cutting the duty on French molasses and making it more affordable, what Grenville's now doing is incentivizing going and buying French molasses. And then you're going to, like a tariff, collect some money on it. That becomes a tax. And Otis immediately recognizes, and he says, this is dangerous because this becomes the first time our parliament is expressing the notion that it has the right to tax us. And any tax is dangerous because while this one may not be that onerous and may be affordable, once a body that you don't send representatives to and it doesn't have to pay the same taxes you pay has the authority to tax you, it's no longer accountable to you, and it could tax away, in theory, all of your property. And that's followed the next year by the Stamp Act, which is more famous. And yes, famously requires an actual official stamp to be placed on almost all paper products, everything from newspapers to legal paper to marriage licenses, even to decks of playing cards. And when, say, a minister who's going to, you know, charge a fee for a license has to buy the stamp, he pays a stamp distributor, that's revenue collected, he passes the cost off to the colonial consumer, and then that's how revenue is collected. Now, what's interesting is that from the start, all of the ideological and constitutional ideas that we've been talking about are brought to bear to denounce both taxes, the sugar and the stamp taxes. But the reason why people haven't heard as much about the Sugar Act and have heard about the Stamp Act is because the Stamp Act generates huge riots and is nullified before it can really go into effect anywhere, briefly in Georgia, but almost nowhere else. And everybody kind of have images of this as sort of the coming of an American Revolution. While the Sugar Act is equally denounced in pamphlet form, it goes into effect and begins to work, and then we'll talk about its aftermath a little bit later. And again, this is the difference between, as I said, the oceans and the interior, right? The Stamp Act, like the Proclamation Line, is vulnerable to what North Americans want to do or don't want to do. It's going to require hundreds, if not thousands, of agents of stamp distributors who have to come from colonial communities themselves, accepting stamps, distributing stamps, and those people are vulnerable to their neighbor's anger, and they can be threatened and intimidated into not doing this, and the act will collapse. Whereas the Sugar Act is collected often literally in the West Indies, certainly on the oceans, policed by the Navy, overseen by salaried bureaucratic customs agents of the empire itself, who are not vulnerable to colonial neighbors and colonial communities. And so what's interesting is that the Sugar Act actually goes into effect. And so all through 1764 and 65, as these acts are being denounced, one thing that shrewd imperial observers like Franklin are noticing is, once again, external measures work, internal measures don't work. They work when colonists don't object to them. They work when colonists do object to them out of the oceans. And internal measures, whether colonists have an ideological objection to them or not, aren't going to work if colonists don't want to participate. And so when the Grenville ministry falls, and it does fall in 1765, believe it or not, for nothing to do with this, it's all about British politics, then it looks scary because the person who's going to replace Grenville is the Duke of Cumberland, right? Billy the Butcher, the guy from Clinton. We know how he reacts, right? And as he's learning in the summer about these Stamp Act riots, he gets angrier and angrier. And he summons a meeting of his ministry for October 31st of 1765, where there's all endless speculation among historians about what that meeting would have done. I believe, given some language he'd sent to governors and who he is, that he was planning a serious military intervention. Now, this would have been October of 1765, well before the Sons of Liberty have barely organized. There's no real colonial connections yet. If he had targeted key areas, I think that would have been a really interesting development.
So obviously, Billy the Butcher, when you're dealing with Highland Scots, that in theory is different when you're dealing with, you know, George Washington and that class. Why does he not have a conception of, like, you know, I'm going to treat these people like I would treat the Irish?
That's a good question. I should go into a bit more detail. So what he's reacting to by October of 1765, they all have news of the huge, vast rioting against the Stamp Act. So what they're seeing is they're not thinking so much about, say, George Washington. And in fact, a lot of the colonial elites that you would all have heard of are deeply worried about the rioting as well. In fact, what they're seeing is this rioting because there's a lot of economic and social conflict and tension in all these colonial communities. And what a lot of these riots, which start off as against stamp distributors, quickly then often will burge into rioting against their own colonial wealthy elite. And so people like Hancock and the Adamses and people in Washington's Virginia of his class are very worried about these riots. But so they're thinking about, what are we going to do about that? And I suspect that the Cumberland or Billy the Butcher, that his response would have been authoritarian. It's literally the case on that day of October 31st, 1765, as he is walking to the meeting, he seized up and died of a heart attack, and he's suddenly dead. And that's another great counterfactual question. What if Cumberland had not died and had lived for another 6 or 8 months and had been in a position to make the decisions about what to do about the obstreperous rotting of the colonies? But suddenly he's gone, and the ministry kind of regroups. And what emerges is its new leader is a man named the Marquess of Rockingham, who I suspect almost no listeners have heard of unless friends of mine decided to tune into this. And the Marquess of Rockingham, who was a confidant of Cumberland's and had actually presented himself as a young teenager at the Battle of Culloden to help him out, and they'd forged a close relationship. But he's a very different kind of guy. This is just the way British politics are. He has a different mentality. He also has a lot of connections to the London mercantile community. And he's got a much, much more of a Pittite understanding of the empire. And what he does is he assembles a lot of London merchants in the fall of 1765 and a lot of colonial agents, including Benjamin Franklin, who was on the scene in London. And he talks through with them, and he learns a lot from Franklin about the empire. And I think he also knew a lot about the empire. He also has a lot of good mercantile contacts, a lot of contact with colonial Americans. And so what they do is they come up with a really sophisticated, essentially smear campaign against the Stamp Act, talking about it as terrible for colonial trade. And what they do is they focus on Franklin's insight to notice that the Sugar Act is working. And they really fall back into the difference between the external realm, where they have a lot more authority and power, and the internal realm. And so what happens in early 1766 is that three pieces of legislation, which are meant to interact together, are enacted by the Rocky administration. The first is they repeal the Stamp Act. Very much a Pittite thing to do. Don't intrude and blunder into the internal realm and provoke people when you've got no plan B. That's what Loudoun did. That's no good. If you can't get their voluntary cooperation, back away. They then don't repeal the Sugar Act. They actually lower the duty even lower to make it even more affordable to go purchase French molasses. They apply the same duty to the English molasses and in a sense create what in the 18th century is a version of free trade. French molasses are treated indistinguishably from English molasses, and they just encourage the colonists to go and buy all of it. And the volume of trade will then raise, you know, more revenue. And in the context of the horrible Stamp Act being repealed and this tax, which is so far away and is going to be assessed by merchants who don't mind it as much as normal other folk might, and they're never really going to see. It's sort of like a sales tax, right? You don't really know where the cost of your good stops and the sales tax starts, right? It's all hidden. The Sugar Act, believe it or not, remains on the books until 1775 and collects about 30 to 40,000 pounds of revenue every year and works exactly the way that people like Franklin had predicted it would. And then they pass what's called the Declaratory Act, which declares that the British government has the authority to pass all laws and statutes concerning the colonies in all cases whatsoever. But note that they do that in this very particular context where the colonists have been acknowledging British legitimate right to govern and pass laws and statutes. What they've been distinguishing is taxes, which could never be lawful and therefore shouldn't be laws and statutes. And Rockingham explicitly rejects language it would have said in all cases of laws and statutes and taxation whatsoever. He drops out the phrase taxation. And so the Declaratory Act is enacted on the same day the Stamp Act is repealed, literally the same day. So the message that's sent to the colony is, we're accepting your distinction, right? We're only going to legislate for you lawfully. We're not going to tax. The Stamp Act's gone, but we are going to continue to tax in this area where you're never really even going to notice it or think about it. And in many ways, that's the most classic Pitt way to handle a great conflict, as you can imagine. And the result is in 1766, all of the Sons of Liberty's groups disband. Peace is restored in the empire, and it really looks as if there's been a real valuable lesson learned in this period from Pitt through 1758, 59, 60, through to Rockingham in early 1766 about how to govern and manage and keep an empire. Then, within a few months, Rockingham is also dismissed from power for reasons that have nothing to do with colonial America, have everything to do with British politics. And you get a new situation, which we can talk about in a moment, but it sounded like you had a question.
Well, no, I mean, I was going to say it. So how do we get from there to the Townshend Acts? What happened?
Okay, right. So the next great crisis is the Townshend Acts. But first of all, let me suggest that in no way does George III, having lost his appetite for provoking the North American colonies, have any interest in further provoking the North American colonies. Rockingham is dismissed, but he'd always been kind of on shaky ground. He's dismissed for reasons that don't have anything to do with British politics. I don't have anything to do with American politics. The king didn't like him. And he replaces him with a man named the Earl of Chatham as the new minister. However, the Earl of Chatham is the title that had been awarded to William Pitt. So my, I always say to my students is, you don't bring William Pitt back if you're looking for further conflict with the North American colonies. He's the great hero. He's the guy who understands this better than anybody. And note that the Townshend Acts are all external taxes. They're following on the lessons that have been learned. These are taxes on goods that are being exported from Britain to North America, paint, lead, window glass, most famously tea. And the assumption is, we've learned how to do it. Never again does Parliament pass an internal tax. They have really learned their lesson here. You go, but the Townshend Acts crisis. So here we have to really, really be very, very careful and scrupulous historians in a way that sometimes people aren't. So the Townshend Acts were passed in 1767. Right away, they lead to pamphlets denouncing them. Again, James Otis denounced the Sugar Act in 1764. Colonial pamphleteers have no problem explaining the constitutional objections to parliamentary taxes. But we all think, the Townshend Acts led to boycott movements, and they do, but not until 1769. Which means that for two significant years, the Townshend Acts are actually working and being collected. And remember, that's on top of the Sugar Act, which is also working and being collected. Now, the Sugar Acts bring in about 30 to 40,000 pounds a year. My estimate is that the Townshend Acts are bringing in another 40,000 pounds a year. And so from having never taxed at all prior to 1764, Parliament by 1768 is collecting 80,000 pounds of revenue a year in taxes by observing the reality of the difference between the internal and the external, even though there's no belief system that can justify it, and by having pretty judicious ministers who are more concerned about what works and results than about what you could justify theoretically or ideologically. Then, for reasons, again, part of this is the dysfunction of British ministerial politics. The Chatham ministry kind of falls apart. For one thing, Chatham is sick by this point and gouty and isn't there very much, and he kind of falls from power. Townshend, the man responsible for the Townshend Acts, believe it or not, dies within a year of enacting them, and there's a real vacuum. And it's filled then by people who once again have more of a hardline approach and mentality coming in, people particularly like the Earl of Hillsborough, a man named Wills Hill. So as I said, right from the start, the Townshend Acts have been denounced. But I have to believe if you're someone like Rockingham and the way he'd handled the stamp crisis, what you would have said is, well, but are they being collected? That's what I care about. And the answer is they are. But in their being denounced, there's a lot of pamphlet literature that's once again challenging British authority. And if you're of a more authoritarian mind, you could say here again is obstreperousness, ungovernability, perhaps even potential for disruption. It has to be dealt with. It has to be responded to. Well, how do you respond? Pitt had responded too in ways that worked really well. Rockingham had responded in ways that worked really well. And then in the midst of this, in early 1768, the Massachusetts legislature, which is always in the vanguard of all of this stuff, passes a really obstreperous denunciation of the Townshend Acts and then puts it in the form of a circular letter, which is meant to circulate to all the other legislatures, calling upon them to denounce the Townshend Acts as well. So once all the legislatures denounce the Townshend Acts,
is this because Massachusetts has a stronger sense of Britishness, if that's a key theme, or is why they're early proto-merchants, manufacturers?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I mean, part of this, I don't think they have a stronger sense, although I think they are one of the most, what we'd call anglicized societies outside of Lowland Scotland or England. I think in certain ways, Boston is a lightning rod. Mostly, I would argue, because it's really suffering by the tremendous success of New York and Philadelphia. I mean, in many ways, it's a little simplistic, but I could say in many ways, a lot of the imperial crisis is the inability to deal with the problems of colonial Boston, which have a lot to do with the fact that it's really been supplanted as the principal port city of North America. And so there's a lot of economic conflict and challenge and stress. And they're for example, they're not happy that the Sugar Act, they're trying to get the other major city, port city merchants to continue to denounce the Amended Sugar Act. And they all say, sure, yeah, we hate it, but they don't denounce. I mean, you know, and so I think that, you know, Boston has a lot of problems. And in many ways, as we get to the ultimate coercive acts, you may note or you may learn, all of those major acts, which ultimately are precipitating of the cause of the conflict, are all actually aimed solely at Boston and Massachusetts. They don't touch any of the other colonies. So there's a perception in the ministerial circles, Boston and Massachusetts are a problem. And part of this is that, yeah, it starts there, right? This the circular letter. Now, what's interesting is the circular letter goes out and it lands in every other colonial legislature, takes longer for the ones further away, but they all have it. And not a single legislature actually takes it up and discusses it. Nobody follows Boston's request. Hillsborough, however, when he learns of the circular letter, reacts angrily anyway. And he issues an order in mid-1768 to every royal governor, ordering them to order their colonial legislatures not to discuss the circular letter and ordering Massachusetts to rescind it, to take it back. Now, when that demand came, none of the colonial legislatures had discussed the circular letter. They'd had it, and from anywhere from a period of weeks to months. This suggests to me that they weren't probably going to discuss it. They don't have the same attitude as Massachusetts. But the order now is something sort of like Loudoun, right? This changes this, right? Because your legislatures are really crucial and important. They need to be able to function as the governing agents of these colonial provinces. And if a precedent is set that these legislatures will only discuss and will only act upon things that they're given permission to act upon, they can't function that way. And so now what all these legislatures conclude is, well, having been ordered not to do it, we have to demonstrate that we can do it. And so every colonial legislature, not before, but only after the order not to discuss happens, all discuss and adopt it. And Massachusetts famously votes not to rescind by a vote of 92 to 17. 92 becomes a number of liberty. Paul Revere famously casts a punch bowl that has 92 scones on it with the names of all the great anti-rescinders. Now, at that point, Hillsborough is kind of in Loudoun territory. What's his plan B? He shouldn't have provoked this. And I got to believe that people like Pitt and Rockingham wouldn't have. But he now can't back down. He's threatened them with either prorogation or dissolution if they discuss, and now they all have. And so between late 68 and early 69, every colonial legislature is either prorogued or dissolved. Now, let me make caution. Dissolved sounds more extreme than it is. Dissolution of a legislature is dissolving the sitting legislature and requiring a new election for a new legislature. Prorogation is dismissing that legislature with the ability to recall that legislature without an election. But the point is that in 68 and 69, every colonial legislature simultaneously is confronted with the threat that the British ministry believes it can determine what they can and can't discuss. So now what they realize, not only do we have to discuss the circular letter, we have to give that teeth by figuring out a way to actually resist the source of it, which is the Townshend Acts. And only do you see in 69 the boycott movements forming. Now, again, I believe for 2 years they didn't form. That didn't have to happen. That looked to me as if this conception of the empire, what I call it, is an organic federal empire, where colonists really don't deal with them in the internal realm unless you can get their voluntary cooperation. Focus your attention on the external realm. That was holding until this. And note that the challenge to the external Townshend Acts comes only when it's connected to the very internal challenge to the colonial legislatures. But having now figured out a way to boycott, and feeling the need that they must boycott, they do, right? If you look at the statistics everywhere except the Chesapeake, those great Virginia planters never join the boycott. They say they do, but you can just look at the import statistics. Imports really drop in 69 into 70. And that creates a challenge. That's an escalation of the crisis. Because if you're thinking about this internal-external division as I've described it, when Parliament retreated from the Stamp Act, it wasn't actually giving up any practical power it ever had anyway. It could never do things internally unless it could get voluntary cooperation. But it had always been able to do things externally, whether the colonists accepted their legitimacy, legislation like the Navigation Acts, or didn't accept their legitimacy, taxation like the Sugar Act. Now, if you were going to employ the Rockingham method, just retreat from where you can't get voluntary cooperation, you'd actually be giving up something you really had had, right? Having given up internal taxation, if you repeal all the external taxes because of the boycotts, you'll be giving up external taxation too. And that means you're not taxing at all, which is acknowledging the colonists' conception of the empire as a place that Parliament can legislate but not tax. You can't do that. So what they do is they give up most of the Townshend Acts. They keep the tax on tea. Right. And so the tax on tea is still there. But let's step back for a moment and think about this, because all through this, the Sugar Act is still in effect and it's completely dropped out of consciousness. As they're boycotting the Townshend Act duties, nobody's even thinking about this. It still continues. It's still raising revenue. And this raises an interesting question that can bring some gender into this as well, right? Because you think about this, you know, people have heard of, there's all these, this robust tavern culture, and, you know, all these people are celebrating the great patriotic, sacrifices of British subjects in the name of liberty. As they're boycotting, a lot of what they're boycotting requires women to do a lot more work, a lot more homespun. The idea of the Daughters of Liberty sacrificing, and taking on these challenges is something that is celebrated in prints. And oftentimes, and also women men drink tea too, but tea has become a real part of women's sociability networks. And there's all kinds of wonderful scholarship about how women's groups really are forming around tea and tea services and the consumption of tea, which, by the way, is a very way to be British, right? I mean, suggests your British, you know, consumption habits. So women are going to have to give that up in the name of liberty. And then North American men, you know, colonists will go to these taverns and toast their wives and daughters and sisters for their incredible sacrifices. And what do they drink in these taverns? They tend to drink rum punch, which comes from sugar, which is coming from the West Indies, which is a taxed commodity. So that, you know, I've always felt like, you know, they're drinking a taxed commodity, which they're not giving up, these men, as they're expecting women to sacrifice and give up tea. But partly that's also because I think it just shows how a tax that wasn't associated with the circular letter, wasn't associated with Thoresi's legislatures, has really dropped out of consciousness, reminding us there always was another way things could have gone. Right. I don't think that particular conflict had to happen, but once it does, it indicts the Townshend Acts, which are associated with the circular letter that is being denounced. And that leads to the need to then retreat from most of these taxes. Now, that leads us to, it also is the case that as these, it's Hillsborough who repositions the soldiers as these conflicts really begin to heat up. And in 1768, many of them from the West, where they're supposed to be policing the proclamation line, to Boston, which is also why in 68 they tend to give up on the proclamation line, which of course creates the charged atmosphere that leads to the Boston Massacre in 1770. And again, if that's the only image we have, we won't remember how well colonial soldiers and officers had worked with British officers during the Seven Years' War. We won't understand the decision of so many British officers and men to remain in North America afterwards. Again, these acrimonious conflicts that we think the Boston Massacre typifies, they do begin to typify the relationship, but it didn't have to be that way, right? But now it is. And so what you get by 1770 is a situation where it's difficult to understand how the British will proceed under the old conditions of the empire that they'd come to learn, which is we can pretty much do things externally. Let's be careful about internally. But note that the colonists have not really changed their position. Their position had always been the British can't tax us. It can govern and legislate us. They're still saying that. And what they want to do, and they're always saying, is go back to the world before you taxed us, which is the world before 1764. What I've always argued is that if you want to return and restore a world you think you've had, that's not revolutionary consciousness. That's literally conservative, right? You want to conserve a world you used to have. In fact, John Dickinson, who is one of the major pamphleteer critics of the Townshend Acts, in his letters for Pennsylvania Farmer, when he's thinking of a word to really discredit those acts, to really explain why they're wrong, the word he comes up with to discredit them is innovation. He says the Townshend Acts are an innovation. Parliament is departing from the relationship that protected British liberty. I've always argued that if you're opposed to innovation, you're not a revolutionary. Right? So what you get is that there's now the tax that's really remained in people's minds is this tax on tea. And so when in 1773, as part of an effort to try to bail out the British East India Tea Company, the British design a new way to tax the tea. What they're doing there is they're trying to do a lot of things, but one thing they're trying to do is keep alive the principle of taxation, but through a really complex and roundabout way with a very sophisticated piece of legislation. The impact of the Tea Act of 1773 is actually to lower the cost of tea in the North American market. And what the British are betting on is the colonists need to be reminded that our taxing them is not the threat they think it is. They've accepted the Sugar Act. They've largely forgotten about it. Largely when we lowered it, we'll lower the cost of tea. We'll remind them that they don't have to be frightened of this act. And in fact, people like Sam Adams are worried that could work. He famously, in a few days before the Boston Tea Party, which is in mid-December of 1773, at a town meeting says, we have to prevent that tea from coming on shore because I'm worried that the people of Boston will buy it and that will undermine our claim to be representative of the people. Now, that's why in many of these other colonies, when tea had come, and if you want, I can go into more detail about why the Tea Act is interesting and complicated, but essentially where tea had come to a lot of other ports, delegations had met them at the wharf and frightened the captains into leaving, getting permission to leave. Again, they're worried about the tea getting on shore. And what has happened in Boston is the royal governor, Thomas Hutchinson, has not given these ships that have come in permission to go, which you can't sail out of the port without papers, which now means that a clock starts where if you come into port and don't have permission to leave, if you haven't either left or landed within 2 weeks, your property will be seized and sold at public auction. And clearly, Hutchinson also agrees with Sam Adams that if he can just get the tea on the wharves, whether it's through the East India Company marketing it or at public auction, people will buy it, and that will undermine the Sons of Liberty's claims to be representative of them, which is why they got to destroy the tea before that happens, and they do. Right. And they throw, I think it's 342, if I remember correctly, chests of tea into Boston Harbor, December 15, 1773, which today would be about 1.5 million pounds worth of tea. So it's a lot of tea, which leads to the ministry, Hillsborough's gone, the ministry of Frederick Lord North, responding with true anger and exasperation with what are called the coercive acts by the Parliament or the intolerable acts by the colonists. And, you know, this is, from the British perspective, like, what do we have to do, right? I mean, we aren't out to threaten their liberty. All we have now are two taxes, a tax on tea and a tax on sugar, which have no lower than they've ever been before and have lowered the price of those commodities below what they were before the taxes were imposed. And they still are, they are ungovernable. They are as uncivilized as the Scottish Highlanders, and we have to treat them accordingly. Now, again, they're also aware that this has been something that happened in Boston, and it's been Massachusetts causing the problem. So the coercive acts that are passed, see if I can do this out of my memory, there are four acts. And the first is the Boston Port Act, which closes the port of Boston down until all the tea is paid for, which is incredibly punitive, right? Boston's already been suffering economically. The only way it could possibly pay for this tea would be if it had an active port. I mean, that indirectly or indirectly throws about half the men of Boston out of work. I mean, it's a really punishing thing. And it kind of is shocking to any colonial port city to think that Parliament thinks it could just do that, right? It's an unthinkable thing. A second act is a much stronger quartering act, which obligates Massachusetts to, you know, to raise funds to quarter troops, but also for the first time gives the Massachusetts governor the authority to quarter troops in private homes if they don't, which is seen as a real violation of British liberty. The third is the Massachusetts Government Act, which forcibly amends the Massachusetts Colonial Charter, which again had been something that would have been seen as unthinkable to all these colonies. They all have charters, so they all wait. Parliament thinks they can just change charters, changes it to make royal government more of a presence in Massachusetts, and also very famously makes the commander of the troops, General Thomas Gage, the new royal governor of Massachusetts. So it's seen as sort of putting Massachusetts under martial law. And the final act is called the Administration of Justice Act, which says that if an agent of the British Empire commits a crime, that he will be tried in an admiralty court rather than a civilian court. And that reminds everybody of the Boston Massacre, because those soldiers had been tried in a civilian court. And actually, they've been represented by John Adams and had been acquitted. They've been seen as provoked. But the point was that civilians of Boston had been able to determine what happened when blood was shed of civilians of Boston. Now what they're saying under this much more acrimonious condition is if agents of the British Empire read these troops kill us, it will be a naval court that will try them, which will probably be very lenient. And therefore, they called it the Murder Act. They said it's encouraging murder. And the final thing the Administration of Justice Act did is it limited all town meetings to one per year in all Massachusetts communities. So these are really punitive. Interestingly, sure, and nothing can be more British than this. You have, as I said, a lot of British people and therefore a lot of British-trained common lawyers in Massachusetts. And one smart guy figures out, he says, hey, you know, if we have a town meeting and we don't officially adjourn it, no matter how long it meets, it's still the same meeting. And so they still meet every night. It's just the same meeting. And what's interesting is Gage, when he hears this, says, well, that's actually true. So there's not much I can do about that. But the coercive acts are in certain ways work out more spectacularly than anything Sam Adams could have hoped for, because they're seen as legislating away British liberty. And the other thing is, what this is where I think revolutionary consciousness really, really is provoked. Because I said, remember, the colonists in many ways are conservative, right? What they're saying is we want to conserve our older conception of the empire where Parliament legislated for us and didn't tax us. And taxation by an unrepresentative body would be the single biggest example of the threat to British liberty. You can legislate for us, you can't tax us. When you think about this coercive acts I've just described them, none of them are taxes. They're all examples of legislation. And what the colonists are forced to confront in 1774 is actually the power to legislate, which we have always granted to Parliament, is a bigger source of danger to our British liberties than the power to tax ever was. Actually, not only can Parliament not tax, if it turns out that granting the power to legislate means the coercive acts, we can't allow Parliament to have the power to legislate either. Now, one, not only is that a new thing, which means now they're being the innovators, but legislation and taxation encompasses all of the things that government does. If you've always said Parliament can't tax, and now you're saying it can't legislate, there is nothing Parliament can do for the colonies. And that, at the very least, means you are independent of Parliament. Well, then what are you? And what they think is, well, can we carve out a separate relationship directly with the king? But that brings out into the open a problem that had always been around from the start. In fact, Franklin is confronted by it in 65, which is, what exactly are these settler colonial societies? What they are these settler colonial societies that are a huge, vast economy that, if it's really independent of Parliament, but has a relationship with the king, could generate its own taxation revenue and give it directly to the king. Well, that would undo the entire Glorious Revolution settlement, where Parliament has sole authority to tax and it holds the king at bay and keeps him in check in constitutional constraint because it has the sole authority to raise revenue. The colonists, in preserving their revenue, their liberties, could in the end threaten the liberties of British people living in Britain. It's just unthinkable. And George III also agrees it's unthinkable. He rejects that view. So at that point, if the king is going to reject that view, which is the only one that will satisfy the colonists, you have to declare your independence from the king as well. And that's what they proceed to do. It doesn't doesn't hurt that when the First Continental Congress reconvenes as the second in 1775 in May, fighting has already started the month before in Massachusetts.
Maybe just a question to wrap up here is that you earlier mentioned that not the colonies didn't want to go along with Massachusetts. There was even trading in the Chesapeake Bay. British Parliament very specifically had these coercive acts focus only on Massachusetts. So maybe just as a final wrap up question, how does everyone get on board? Particularly, how did the Virginia Planter class get on board?
Yeah, and maybe how does that contribute also to the debate around what do we do here? Do we declare independence? Yeah. Do we go another route? Like with the debates within the Continental Congress.
Yeah. So there's a medium long burn and then a really quick burn. So one thing is that the conditions have been getting worse since 1769, 70, the Boston Massacre. People are becoming less confident that their liberties are safe in Britain. And so you're getting greater anger and frustration, and it's easier to provoke the colonies in the 1771, 72, and 73. And then, so that's in that sense, it's just less goodwill. The colonists keep talking about disaffection, which of course means that they once had affection, right? You were causing our disaffection. So there's just, I think, a general sense of anger that what they thought they had settled and what they thought everybody understood continues to come back. And then I think we cannot underestimate the enormity of the coercive. I mean, again, Parliament calls them the coercive acts, right? The colonists call them intolerable acts, but Parliament isn't hiding what it's doing. Yes, they're only aimed at Massachusetts, but as with taxation, if Parliament really believes that it can legislate away a colonial charter, well, every colony has a colonial charter. They all have to be worried about that, right? If Parliament believes it can shut down a major portion of a port city's economy, which is then connected to the rest of that colony's economy, that can happen in Philadelphia or Massachusetts or Philadelphia or New York or Charleston as well. If Parliament believes that it can actually actively undo the trial by jury for crimes committed against civilians, that's a threat to everyone everywhere. So in many ways, while Parliament believes that this will be understood and interpreted as simply aiming at the malefactors of Massachusetts, more and more colonies can see this as an enormity that could immediately impinge upon their own British liberties. I think it really is seen as unthinkable and intolerable, and that's why it gets called that. And in that sense, it generates what the Townsend Acts never did, which is once again a colonial-wide Congress, in which, unlike the Stamp Act Congress, where only 9 colonies came, now 12 colonies come up at Georgia. And they're really clearly very, very anxious and worried. But they're also confronted with the fact that what they're really now doing is indicting Parliament's authority to legislate, which has enormous implications, because that means they're departing from their own view of the empire. And so I'm sorry, you said you wanted to see how that exactly got to the decision to declare independence. Right. So what they do, so interestingly, what they do at the end of that First Continental Congress, which ends in September of 1774, as they said, they'll meet again in May of 1775. In the meanwhile, they'll send all kinds of petitions to Parliament outlining this new sense. They want to have a direct relationship with the king and that Parliament can't legislate or tax, with the hope that will be accepted, which it isn't, and they'll see where they are. Well, not only is that those petitions not accepted and not even read, but when they reconvene in April, they've inherited a war, right? I mean, Lexington and Concord have happened. Boston is now under siege. Washington famously shows up in that uniform. It still fits him from the French and Indian War. People like John Adams are determined to try and get someone like Washington, who's not a Massachusetts man, up to Massachusetts to take over an army to show that this is a continental-wide concern. And increasingly, I think that's the sense of things. But one thing I want to suggest is this, and this might, we don't have to end on it unless you want to, but in some a good place to land, is in 1774, what the colonists are offering is, you know, their final effort is they essentially say, look, Parliament can no longer legislate for us or tax us. But what they don't want to give up is the fact that it's been a really, really good deal to be part of this incredibly prosperous British Empire. So what they offer is, what they say is, what we will do is, they say, we will voluntarily, cheerfully abide by any pieces of legislation that bona fide regulate our external commerce. Well, that's a fancy way of saying we'll still respect the Navigation Acts. They don't want to give them up. But we have to make sure you understand it's voluntary, because the power to legislate that leads to the Navigation Acts is the same power of legislation that leads to the Coercive Acts, which we have to reject. That gets rejected. And as a result, the fighting, you know, there's last-ditch efforts in 1775 to figure out some new accord. There's just no way that any ministry or the king in Parliament can accept anything that doesn't acknowledge parliamentary sovereignty. And at this point, they now feel that it's come full circle, that the colonists always had planned to seek independence and are the nefarious figures the authoritarian civilizers always said they were. Didn't have to be that way, but now that's a general view by a lot of people. But what's interesting is that fast forward a few years to 1778, the French finally come in and they align, and now the Americans have a navy, and now the West Indies are in play, and things look really bad. I mean, the British Empire now has to confront its old alliances of enemies, but now with North America on the other side. And the British begin to be worried. They immediately shift a lot of ships down to the West Indies. They immediately focus there. And they offer essentially the same deal back in 1778 to the North Americans. Say, would you be willing to come back into this deal where we'll end hostilities? You'll voluntarily, in a sense, participate in a broad British imperial oceanic relationship, commercial relationship, and you'll have internal autonomy. Now, at that point, the war has gone on for years. There's no way are the Americans going to take it. But that deal is only 4 years apart. And so one counterfactual we could speculate about is, what if the British had been willing in 1774 to accept what they were willing to offer and did offer in 1778? The colonists are there in 1774. What that would have led to, in a kind of more ad hoc version, dimly, but I think pretty powerfully, is what, in a sense, the British do create in their second British Empire with their Commonwealth system, where increasingly what they do is they give more and more internal autonomy, note, to their white settler colonial possessions, Canada, Australia, South Africa, not to their not white ones, but to their settler colonial possessions, while those colonies continue to persist, to participate in a broad, coherent, oceanic commercial empire overseen by the British Empire. And what you could have, and so in that sense, what you're seeing is that in many ways coming out of this, if the empire had always been organically a federal system, a place where the colonists had authority and power internally, and Britain had a power externally, both sides learn their version of federalism. The United States creates a federal system of government that recognizes this vast landmass and the challenges of a central authority governing in ways where it can't get the voluntary support and cooperation of its localities. And the British in the 19th century move to an imperial system that will largely deal structurally with these kinds of internal, external questions and challenges.
Well, happy July 4th, everyone. Andrew, that was a tour de force. I learned so much. Thank you so much.
Yeah, you're welcome.
For joining us. I think everyone should play this at their barbecues on repeat, and people could learn a thing or two about the American Revolution and its choice for independence. That was fantastic. We would love to have you back again. Thank you so much, and have a great holiday.
You as well. Thank you so much.